For anyone with Kevin's record, the Security Pacific job should have been out of the question. When he applied in early March for the opening as an electronic funds transfer consultant in the bank's audit department, he knew the chances of getting it were remote. His reputation as a computer criminal was more difficult to shake loose than he had thought it would be. A few months earlier, he had taken a job at GTE as a COBOL programmer. He had worked there for only a week before the security department checked his background. A security officer then approached him one day, escorted him to his car, and waited to see that he left the premises. It was a humiliating episode. Most of his other jobs had opened for him through family connections. Had the bank managers at Security Pacific known that a computer criminal would be in constant contact with the computer system that executed, monitored, and logged hundreds of millions of dollars of transactions every day, they would have been aghast. Kevin diligently completed the job application. For the standard query, "Have you ever been convicted of or are you pending trial for a criminal offense?" he placed a small, bold check next to "No." An unusual collection of references included Donald Wilson, his former employer at National GSC, Arnold Frohman, owner of Frohman's Delicatessen and his mother's boyfriend, and Roscoe. Then, in a surprising concession to the cloak of secrecy he had maintained for the past 3 years about his time as a fugitive, Kevin tipped his hand. Perhaps to boost his otherwise anemic educational background, he noted on the application that in the winter and spring of 1985, just when the police had him on a kibbutz in Israel, he was a student at Butte College, a 2-year community college in Oroville, a small town in Northern California, about 250 miles northeast of San Francisco. Kevin had apparently remained anonymous by enrolling under an assumed name. Kevin told Lenny that if he got the job at Security Pacific, he would stop breaking into computers for good, and it seemed that he might get the job. With a little embellishment here and there, on paper, Kevin didn't look bad at all. He listed his job at National GSC, where he had spent so much time on the telephone, as a programmer analyst. At Frohman's Delicatessen, where his primary job was that of delivery man, with a little computer work on the side, he was also a programmer analyst. Both businesses were owned by friends of the family, who could be expected to give good references. When he received the letter from the bank's personnel office confirming an annual salary of $34,000, Kevin was ecstatic. His first day of work, the letter informed him, would be March 25th, when he was to report to the training center downtown for an orientation. The last paragraph of the letter was boilerplate. "As discussed, your employment is contingent upon satisfactory reference checks." When Bonnie got home from work, a smiling Kevin told her he had been offered the job. They went out to dinner to celebrate. Black got the tip about Mitnick's new job on March 23rd. He called the bank's security department immediately. The next day, Black got a call from Peter Kiefer, a Security Pacific vice president. "Yes," he told Black, "the bank had just offered Mitnick a job in its electronic funds transfer section. Mitnick was to start work the following day." Late that afternoon, Kiefer and a colleague named Barry Himmel arrived at police headquarters to talk with Black. They presented Black with Mitnick's application and his list of references. They also showed him an article that had been clipped from the Los Angeles Times, dating back 7 years to 1981, and telling of three young men, Kevin Mitnick among them, who had been arrested for stealing manuals from Pacific Bell's downtown computer center in order to wreak havoc on the telephone company and its computer systems. The story had been brought to their attention by a bank employee who knew of Mitnick from his involvement in amateur radio. The worried executives asked Black if this happened to be the same Kevin Mitnick who was about to start work as a security consultant at Security Pacific. By that point, Black's confirmation was hardly necessary. The two security officers had already established a strong link. As one of his references, Kevin Mitnick had listed the true name of Roscoe, one of the three arrested in 1981 for breaking into the Pacific Bell Cosmos Center. It was an awkward situation, to be sure. A decade earlier, Security Pacific had been the victim of a historic heist. The thief, Stanley Rifkin, a plump and soft-spoken 32-year-old computer expert, had worked there as a computer security consultant and walked away one afternoon with the day's code for the bank's electronic funds transfer system. Later that same day, Rifkin phoned the wire transfer room and, using a fictitious name, said he was with the bank's international division. He rattled off a few security codes, and his $10 million withdrawal sailed through. Rifkin was eventually caught, but the bad publicity surrounding the bank's security system had stuck with the bank over the years. No one wanted a repeat performance. When Barry Himmel called Black the following day, he said Mitnick had been informed in person that the employment offer had been withdrawn. Mitnick's response, Himmel reported, was simply to smile. There was a pause. Then Himmel asked, "Did Jim Black think Mitnick was the type of person to seek revenge in any way?" "If he were to seek revenge," Black answered, "it would most likely be through his knowledge of computers and telecommunications." 2 weeks later, Black got another call from Himmel. He told Black that one of the officers of the bank had just had a call from a news service in San Francisco seeking confirmation and more details about a press release from Security Pacific that had come over the wire earlier that day. The release stated that for the first quarter of 1988, Security Pacific was going to show an earnings loss of $400 million. The only clue Himmel had that the release was a forgery was the absence of a customary sign-off identifying the source of the story. Of course, Himmel told Black, the story was completely false. Apprised of the fraudulent press release, the bank's corporate officers were horrified. The potential damage to the bank if such a release got into the newspapers was incalculable. In plunging stock value and account closures alone, it could exceed the $400 million reported in the fictitious press release. Fortunately, the hoax was stopped in time. Again, Himmel paused. Could this egregious act possibly have been committed by Mitnick? "It was possible," Black replied, "but he couldn't verify it. Nobody ever could." Computer crime cases were notoriously difficult to investigate, and that was part of the appeal for Black. The little evidence that could be gathered was difficult to tie directly to a suspect. Companies and universities whose computers had uninvited nocturnal visitors could produce dozens of pages of computer printouts covered with blatant evidence of the intrusion, but they didn't necessarily add up to much in the way of evidence. Telephone traps were useful only as far as they went. Intruders such as Mitnick, who had started out as phone freaks, were expert at covering their tracks. When someone like Mitnick got into a telephone company computerized switch, he could treat the vast telephone network like a series of disappearing stepping stones, manipulating the machines to create fictitious billing numbers and forward calls to non-existent telephones. Black saw computer crime as the ultimate challenge. Not only was the technology interesting, but he enjoyed thinking about a computer criminal's mindset. Computer criminals hardly fit the common profile of an outlaw. The old investigator's axiom, "We catch only the dumb ones," seemed to break down when it came to computer crime. There were no dumb ones. More often, they were caught because a friend or an associate snitched. Black believed that Mitnick and his circle had been snitching on one another for years, stretching all the way back to the Cosmos incident. But the original gang Mitnick was involved with appeared to have long since split up. Susan Thunder hadn't surfaced for a few years, and after a prostitution arrest in 1982, followed by a bizarre incident in 1984 in which she and a friend tried to spring their friend Stephen Rhodes from jail by impersonating a deputy district attorney, Susan had apparently given up her computer security consulting in favor of beating the odds at professional poker. Both Roscoe and Rhodes seemed to have gone straight by this time, and as far as Black could tell, neither of them was involved in this incident. Black had never worked directly on a case involving Mitnick before, but Mitnick appeared to be one of the few old phone freaks, perhaps the only one, who had kept his skills honed. From experience, Black knew that this was a case that would require a lot of close cooperation from Pacific Bell and digital equipment. Not only was Pierce College using digital equipment, but this VPA outfit was as well. Black had little doubt that Mitnick had devoted hundreds of hours to refining his talents on digital computers. Black knew that Mitnick's technical ability far exceeded that of most investigators, especially those unschooled in the subtle art of exploring computer crime. The Santa Cruz operation incident was case in point. Black and his colleagues had been stunned to hear of the careless way in which the Santa Cruz police detectives had conducted the search of Vitello's apartment. Why hadn't anyone told them not to take the phone off the hook? Now that Black knew where the two suspects were working from, he asked Pacific Bell to put a dialed number recorder on the VPA phone to register outgoing calls. After 11 days of bureaucracy bashing, Black was able to get the tap. It yielded a number of surprising calls, several to non-working, unassigned phone numbers, others made to the MCI local access using pirated authorization codes. Among the most interesting calls were those made to a New Jersey Bell Cosmos computer similar to the one Mitnick had been caught breaking into at Pacific Bell 7 years earlier. There was also a call to a New York City-based subsidiary of Security Pacific, called Precision Business Systems. This company managed data communications for the West Coast Bank. The FBI's New York office had recently been investigating a possible wire theft case involving Security Pacific. In early April, someone had attempted to get into the bank's secured data communications lines. Although Black thought he had enough evidence from the Pierce incident to nail Mitnick and DeSico on computer fraud charges, he kept holding out for more. While intriguing, the Precision Business Systems lead was still too sketchy. Black wanted enough evidence to warrant a substantial prison sentence, and he hoped to get it from the VPA surveillance. But in late summer, another case forced him to put the investigation on hold and end the surveillance temporarily. In the meantime, Pierce College had brought its own case against Mitnick and DeSico. The college held a disciplinary hearing, for which the two suspects put together their own defense, exhibiting enough legal acumen to draw the hearing out to an exhausting 21 hours. When Black set aside the criminal case, they were appealing their expulsion. It had been a frustrating exercise for Black. These investigations hinged on the close cooperation of law enforcement agencies and commercial institutions working together against a common foe. The detective had hoped for instant help from both Pacific Bell and Digital Equipment. Instead, Pacific Bell's bureaucracy had stonewalled his efforts, and although he had received immediate help from the local digital office, Black couldn't seem to get the attention of security people at headquarters in Massachusetts. He hadn't been able to trace any of Mitnick and DeSico's outgoing calls to a major computer system. Still, he was sure that somewhere out there a computer system administrator was having Black's problem in reverse, wondering who the invader could be.